Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Mike Fader. This is Mike Fader with The Turning Point, and just let me remind you before we begin today's show that, once again, if you have anything to comment about, anything to say about something you hear on this program, agreements, disagreements, additions, corrections, feel free to get in touch with me by going to my website. It's The Fader Files, FEDER FIDER FILES.com, FaderFiles.com. And while you're there, you can check out some other things that I have done and am doing. I wanted to start off by saying we have a guest today, but just let me have a little introduction here. With everything that's going on in the world now, with all the civil wars and the complicated invasions and bombings and terrorist acts and who knows what else is going on under the table in negotiations. One thing that's being ignored or that's been put on the back burner, which was and still is and remains a serious, put it mildly, a serious problem, is Guantanamo, the American imprisonment of detainees at the Guantanamo Naval Base prison. And it sits there still in our own backyard. It's an unhealed sore, and it's a symbol of our abuse of our own alleged principles of democracy, which apply in some cases and not in others, apparently, and of human rights, abuse. And it's hypocrisy again. And it's also still a recruiting tool. For people all over the world who need an excuse, if they even need an excuse, to to attack the United States and to feel like the United States is a villain on the scene of world affairs. And Guantanamo remains. We have with us a guest today, Mr. Omar Shaker. Am I saying your name right?
Yeah, sure. It's Omar Shaker, but Omar Shaker is, yeah.
Omar Shaker. Okay.
Yeah.
And again, he is a lawyer who is a Bertha Fellow at the Center for Constitutional Rights, where he focuses on unlawful detentions at Guantanamo Prison, U.S. targeted killing practices, and Palestinian rights issues. And prior to joining the Center for Constitutional Rights, he was a fellow at Human Rights Watch, where he investigated human rights abuses in Egypt and was lead researcher and author of All According to Plan, a report that documents the mass killings of protesters in Egypt in July and August of 2013. He's also the co-author of Living Under Drones, a joint Stanford-NYU report documenting civilian consequences of U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan. And these drone strikes continue in various parts of the world and are still having their consequences for civilians. Tell me a little bit about the Center for Constitutional Rights. When was it founded? Who founded it? Who runs it? How is it funded?
Sure. CCR is actually celebrating in 2016 its 50th anniversary. We were founded during the Civil Rights Movement to be an organization committed to ensuring adherence to the U.S. Bill of Rights and the U.N. Declaration of Human Rights. We focus on issues of human rights and social justice here in the United States. Our work spans issues from racial justice and government misconduct, cases like challenging the Stop and Frisk program in New York, to challenging solitary confinement in California, to issues related to national security. We were the first attorneys that went down to Guantanamo when the prison was opened under the Bush administration and brought the cases that established the rights of detainees to habeas corpus. And we've continued over the last 14 years to be, engaged in legal work and advocacy around Guantanamo, to our work on targeted killing, surveillance, the whole sort of gamut of national security abuses or abuses in the name of national security, to work that we do on international human rights, from torture committed by the United States overseas to issues like the role of U.S. actors in fostering persecution of LGBTI communities in Uganda. We're funded by individual donors. We don't take any corporate or government money, we have a staff based here in New York City that covers a wide range of issues.
And I'll ask you later on to repeat it, but what's the website if people want to get in touch with you?
CCRjustice.org.
CCRjustice.org. And what's your background before you worked at CCR?
Sure. So I am an attorney. I've worked on a human rights attorney. I've worked on different issues from my role in writing a report about the effects of drone practices on communities in Pakistan. I was involved with the Stanford International Human Rights Clinic. Before joining CCR, I was a fellow at Human Rights Watch, where I was based in Cairo, covering Egypt, writing reports on a range of issues, my major report having been on the killings of protesters after the military coup in Egypt in July 2013. And I've been at CCR now for about a year and a half, working on issues including Guantanamo, targeted killing, and representation of Professor Stephen Salaita, who was fired for tweets criticizing Israel. So a range of issues and international human rights and national security.
So do you currently represent men who are being held in Guantanamo?
Yes. I'm one of the attorneys here at CCR that does represent men currently detained in Guantanamo. I've been to the prison three times in the last couple of months. I'm heading down again on Thursday in relation to our legal work representing men there.
When you before I ask you about these cases and about other issues involved here, when you go down to talk to your clients down there, do you take it for granted you're being recorded?
I mean, you're heading down to a military base, you're heading down to Guantanamo. We've seen sort of the range of abuses that take place, including infringements on the rights of detainees to counsel. You know, when we do meet clients, we are in a camp in which there is a camera that does, you know, a supposed, you know, that does only, you know, supposedly video record, you know, what takes place there. But, you know, we operate in an environment where, you know, we realize that that the military and that other actors have in the past, you know, abused the rights of detainees to counsel, whether making it incredibly difficult for them to visit the base, whether it is, you know, recording meetings between clients and attorneys, whether it be, you know, the normal process, which is everything, every note that I take during a meeting is reviewed by a classification team within the U.S. government before I'm even able to access those notes. So these are all things that we as a Guantanamo bar that have worked on Guantanamo for many years have come to take for granted, but in when you take a step back and look at it, really do make this work incredibly challenging.
So these men are subject, just so people are reminded about this, because, you know, that sometimes with all the news that floods into our heads every day, 24/7, with all the different news media, people forget about Guantanamo. It's sort of like, you know, falls underneath all this other stuff. So what, when, just one more follow-up question about the notes. When you take your notes, they're reviewed, and you can bring them out. But when you go down there to represent these men, they're still under military tribunals. They're not part of the, of course, they're not part of the federal court system, right?
Sure. Let me just add clarification on the notes. We actually don't take our notes out. Every note we take during meetings are submitted to a government classification team.
Really?
I cannot take them out of those meetings. And once those are reviewed, then, you know, whatever has been approved is then faxed to us sometime later. So we don't actually take notes out of that meeting.
Well, have some of your notes been, you know, have been, censored before?
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, I mean, regularly you receive notes that are, for one reason or another, that are redacted or censored in some ways. That is a common, very common practice.
Amazing.
So to your question, you know, I think it's important to remember there have been nearly 800 men detained at Guantanamo, all of whom are Muslim men and boys since the prison opened in January 2002. Of those nearly 800 individuals, 10 have been charged with a crime. And those individuals that have been charged with crimes have indeed been tried through military commissions. The remaining individuals that, you know, the vast majority, 99% of detainees have never been charged with a crime. Some of them, the majority of those, many of those 800 who have, you know, were cleared for release and have been released by the U.S. government. Currently today in Guantanamo, we have 107 men who remain detained there, of whom 48 have been cleared for release, meaning that every agent, security agency of the U.S. government has reviewed their files, both related to their conduct before entering Guantanamo and during incarceration, and decided that they do not pose a continuing significant threat to the United States and should be cleared for release.
But they're still there.
Sorry?
I mean, but how long have they been cleared? I mean,
many have been cleared since 2009 when the Obama administration did a review of every detainee. Some have been cleared more recently through a process that the Obama administration has set up called the Periodic Review Boards. But, you know, many have been cleared for now, you know, almost 7 years. And those individuals remain languishing there, not of, obviously of their own volition, but because this administration has, you know, lacked the political will to actually release them, in part a result of restrictions enacted by Congress, but really in reality, this administration, in spite of those restrictions, has the legal authority to release those individuals. It has released some. You know, we recently had several, just a couple weeks ago, several releases to the United Arab Emirates. We've had others in 2015 and 2014, but it's been a you know, nothing more than a, you know, a trickle of releases when we need really something far more wide-reaching to actually close Guantanamo during the Obama administration. So you have nearly 48 that are cleared for release. You have 10 that have either been charged, that have actually been convicted, or are going through the military commissions process, which includes, that's 10 individuals, including those that are charged with involvement in the 9/11 attacks, which, as a side note, that case is nowhere near going to trial. We're several years at least. People are now saying 2020 at the earliest. What? And the remaining individuals, outside of those, the 10 in the military commissions and the 48 that have been cleared for release, I think about 47, if my math is correct, I may be off by one or two, are actually in the indefinite detention category, meaning that the U.S. government has decided that it lacks the evidence, or the evidence has been tainted by torture, or it just doesn't have it, to charge them with a crime, but at the same time, they have not yet cleared them for release. That includes one of the men I represent as well. And those individuals are going through the process of obtaining their clearance. So I have a client that has a hearing to determine whether or not he'll be cleared for release on December 8th, which is why I'll be traveling down to the base on Thursday.
It's hard to know even how to respond to this. I mean, there is no excuse, I guess. I suppose some people might say, well, they're not United States citizens and they're not due the usual protections of a United States citizen. But they I don't understand. There is no explanation, right? Is there an explanation that they ever give people or give the world or give you? Why people are being held against every constitutional protection that would cover an American citizen?
You know, I think it varies, right? I mean, I think, unfortunately, the problem is that, as I think you alluded to earlier, I think Guantanamo has sort of fallen off the radar of many in this country, even those that, in 2007, President Bush at the time, Canada and Obama, Canada and McCain all agreed on closing Guantanamo. It was a consensus issue. President Obama comes to office on the back of that promise on day two in office, signs an executive order to close Guantanamo, and I think many declared victory and, decided to move on to the next issue. And of course, there's no shortage of, as you mentioned, news headlines and really distressing human rights concerns to keep us busy, but Guantanamo was never a mission accomplished. I mean, it started soon after that executive order when President Obama, failed to sort of follow through and immediately release men. Instead, he went through this year-long review process, and then, when the political costs went up, Republicans smelled potential weakness, they came in strong and that caused many in the Democratic aisle to cave in. And, as Rahm Emanuel said, Daniel Kleinman's book, Guantanamo was compared to the flock of seagulls that threatened to bring down the plane that was the Obama presidency. Mm-hmm. And it's continually been the issue that President Obama isn't willing to cave on. First, it was the Obamacare. More recently, it was the Iran deal. But it's always the issue that is just not that important, and there really hasn't been we haven't been loud enough as a movement demanding that Guantanamo close in spite of the best efforts of many. The explanations always vary from, people who say, it's complicated, there's internal dynamics, there's Congress. You usually get a lot of excuses and people blaming others, right, whether it be the Department of Defense or Congress, or other countries, not willing to take men, when in the reality is that it's really ultimately boils down to the fact that President Obama and his administration has not, shown the political will to take the steps necessary to close the prison.
Where before I ask you another question, where would they go? I mean, let's say everybody was, let's say everything was speeded up and everything was done, everybody got their due process. And you had 95% of the people who were down there cleared of any wrongdoing and ready to be released. Where would they be released to?
So, many would be repatriated to their homes. The U.S. has sent many men back to their homes. But really, where they go is not an issue because many of the men are willing and open to going to many third countries, to being resettled in third countries.
Sure.
And we've seen a wide range of countries from Uruguay, to Georgia, to the United Arab Emirates, to Oman, that have been willing to take resettled detainees in their countries. And you know, we continually talk to foreign to foreign embassies, and that's never been the issue. There, you know, there are many countries, whether it be for humanitarian reasons, whether it be for political reasons, that are happy to settle. Men that have been held at Guantanamo and never been charged with a crime, many of whom were in the wrong place at the wrong time. Mm-hmm. The problem has never been where they go. The problem has been within the U.S. government getting all of the signatures and clearances to get them on a plane and out of Guantanamo, even after having, in many cases, in almost all cases, having been cleared by every, you know, security agency, military branch of the U.S. government.
Now, does the president of the United States, Obama, whoever it is, but in this case we're talking about Obama because it's been going on so long, does he have the authority to just pick up the phone and, you know, having found homes for these people who are ready to be released, let's say, countries who are ready to accept them, can he just pick up the phone and, as commander-in-chief, after all, it's a military base, can he just order that these people be put on a plane and sent to these countries just like that?
Congress has, you know, set up certain requirements, including that they're notified 30 days before a transfer is carried out, including that the Secretary of Defense sign a waiver or certification, certifying that the men released won't engage in terrorist activities post their release. So there are legislative restrictions, but those merely, you know, relate to signing a waiver and giving notification, which is what this largely has been done with Guantanamo releases. I think there is a legal argument to be made that it's within the Article 2 executive power of the president,
right,
to carry out transfers without going through those requirements. I think there are good arguments on both sides of that, but the reality is, you know, even adhering to the restrictions in Congress, you know, of getting Secretary of Defense to sign and giving Congress notification, this can be done in a way that accords with that law.
Mm-hmm.
President Obama today were to sign, you know, the releases for the 48 men that have been cleared for release, they could be out of Guantanamo before 2016.
So it seems like many other issues that he's just sort of the same as Bush, but now especially with Mr. Obama, who was promised, you know, as one of his campaign original campaign promises was to shut the base down. He's just sort of like letting it drag along until the next person has to deal with it. If you just tuned in, we're talking to Mr. Omar Shakir, and he is a Bertha Justice Institute fellow at the Center for Constitutional Rights. He's a lawyer and represents some of the men who are still at Guantanamo. If you remember Guantanamo, there was a defense bill that was recently passed, the National Defense Authorization Bill, $600 billion. And some of the provisions undermine his ability to close Guantanamo.
Right, yes. I mean, there certainly are restrictions in this new NDAA that, you know, restrict the president's ability to close Guantanamo. I think nothing in there is, closes the door on transfers. I think it sort of more ups the cost of doing so. A lot of the NDAA's restrictions are subject to interpretation, and I think there certainly is a very plausible interpretation that does not close the door on transfers and makes it more difficult, such as by containing reporting requirements of countries that take in detainees regarding their activities that are quite onerous. But the reality is, even post-NDAA, this administration can continue to release the men that have been cleared,
mm-hmm.
For release or transfer. So again, it's another one of those. And of course, Congress has said that, if President Obama were to have put forward a plan to close Guantanamo, that would have been open to sort of reviewing and potentially lifting those restrictions. But again, those restrictions, while certainly making it more difficult to transfer Guantanamo detainees, do not close the door on transfers.
Hold on one second. We're going to take a slight break for a second. Can Hi, you there?
Yes.
Yes, sorry, we just had a little technical problem here. I wanted to ask you, if the all the detainees, no matter what state they're in now, if the ones that are able to be released, who have been cleared for the release, the ones who are in some indefinite limbo, and the ones who are who haven't even gone to trial yet, which is hard to even believe. You know, I don't understand any of this. I mean, it just has nothing to do with anything that I understood to be being an American, or has something to do with the Constitution at all. But all of these people could be transferred to a federal prison somewhere, couldn't they? In the United States, in the domestic United States.
Sure. I mean, you know, all along there's been the specter that, you know, Guantanamo could be closed and the men could be sent to a federal prison. The reality is Congress has now, for several years, explicitly passed legislation forbidding the use of for funds to transfer people to the United States, for their detention in the U.S. So that has been rejected by Congress. So if the president were to do that, he would have to override congressional legislation that has been passed. Mm-hmm. Of course, for many of us that have worked on Guantanamo for many years, transfer to a federal prison is not an outcome that we support. The issue of Guantanamo has never been its zip code, although, of course, its location has been part of, you know, keeping it out of the American mainstream, and, of course, for many years has been a location for terrible abuse and torture. However, you know, the issue is really indefinite detention without charge. It's the reality that there are hundreds of men, dozens still now to this day, that have been held for years and years, not only without charge, but without knowing, without having a day in court, without knowing when they might be released, having any sense of what process they might go through
and
to get out of there.
And this would continue.
And that's really the central issue. And, mm-hmm. you know, transferring men to the United States not only fails to address that underlying issue, not only is it terribly demoralizing, imagining being in Guantanamo for 14 years and your day finally comes to leave, but you're only leaving to go to a prison in the United States,
mm-hmm.
It actually creates an entire legal category in U.S. law of people being held without charge. And that's a terrible legal precedent that, threatens to be used, in the future with any unsavory enemy of the day.
Mm-hmm. So what is the Center for Constitutional Rights, or what can anybody do about a situation like this? I mean, what can a citizen do about a situation where the government has just decided to act in any way it wants to without regard to the Constitution or to human rights?
I think the key thing is to keep, Guantanamo, needs to continue to be at the forefront of the radar of those that care about the rule of law and human rights here in the United States. I think that means, doing what you can to raise awareness about cases. You know, if you go to our website, ccrjustice.org, you can read about many of our clients' cases. And you can, post about them on social media, you can write to your elected officials, you can, organize events to, keep Guantanamo in the public radar. I think the more that can sort of be done to let folks, especially in this administration, I actually do think, in spite of everything that I've said, mm-hmm. that President Obama himself and people within his certain people within his administration actually really do want to close, between quotes, Guantanamo. That probably doesn't mean closing Guantanamo in the way that you or I may want, which means releasing all those that have not been charged with a crime, and for those that we believe, were involved in a criminal activity, to charge them you know, and fair, you know, processes in federal court in the United States. But I think there is some desire, but the reality is the political costs of Guantanamo are cutting the other way. You have fear mongers in Congress and in the media that insist that these men are terrorists, that they are you know, that they are all, you know, Bin Laden's close associates. The reality is, again, all but 10 have not been charged with a crime. Many of these, as even former U.S. officials have said, are not the worst of the worst, but the unluckiest of the unlucky. Happen to have been at the wrong place at the wrong time. Many of the men still there, out of the 48 cleared for release, you know, I think 42 are Yemenis. So, you know, and their reason for staying there is solely because of their country of origin. They can't be, according to the U.S. government, sent back there. So, and they're worried about even sending them to third countries out of fear that they may go back to Yemen. So solely on the basis of their nationality, they're stuck in limbo. So I think the what people can do is just to raise awareness as much as you can about this issue, mobilize. There was really last week and on Thanksgiving, a group of brave demonstrators that did a march in Cuba and held a demonstration right outside the gates of Guantanamo prison. Obviously not everybody can go do that, but I think the more that, you know, folks can keep Guantanamo on the public radar, not just as an issue writ large, but, you know, talk about the specific men that are there. I think the more we can, hopefully push for closure.
Do you mind one last question about, speaking of things that might be unconstitutional or, the climate that's going on now, you know, after the attacks in Paris and the troubles, understatement for it, in Syria. There are all of these governors that have declared that they are refusing to accept refugees from Syria who have been waiting years to get away from that hell there and, to wherever they are now, to maybe in Jordan or someplace, to get into the United States. I mean, can these governors individually in each state say they are refusing to accept refugees to the United States? Is that legal for them to do that?
You know, I think the U.S. government, you know, the short answer is it's complicated, but really no. I mean, I think these are sort of generally immigration is an issue that's handled at the federal level. That's a determination that's made by federal authorities, yes, folks are certainly resettled in different states, but that the decision making and the legal process by which that happens is all at a federal level. So, yeah, the answer in short is legally no, but of course, in practice, there are many ways in which state level officials and agencies and institutions can erect barriers that, in practice, make it difficult for resettlement to happen. But in short, the answer would be no, because this is an issue that, relates to federal law and federal government decision-making.
Well, all right. I appreciate you coming on today. And once again, Mr. Omar Shaker, who is who is representing some of the men who are still, after all these years, detained at Guantanamo, some of them not even charged with a crime, and the ones that have been cleared are not being released and have been languishing for years. And a few of them who actually have been charged with a crime haven't even received a trial. So I think it's something we should all be remember and to be concerned about in the midst of all these other things that are happening. And CCRjustice.org, right?
Correct.
Okay, thanks for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay, we're back. Yeah, my guest about Guantanamo, it seems like there's just no way to keep track of all these abuses, domestically, internationally, all the terrorism, all the violence, all the violations of our own rights. But they all seem to be part of a pattern of, and you can, if you're a history buff or if you've read about history, that's a word I never really liked too much, buff, but if you've read about history, you see that these things have a kind of an arc to them, these kinds of things getting out of control in the world, before World War I, before World War II, but especially before any kind of major world war or conflagration. And God knows what this one would be like. You don't even want to think about it, considering the actors or the countries involved and the weapons that are available freely almost everywhere all over the world that didn't exist, except that the United States had them in World War II and used them at the very end of the war. But now, you know, there are many, many countries with weapons. Any kind of world war would be the end of the world, not one country or one group of allies or, you know, countries triumphing over another group and imposing their will on them, or things being back to quote-unquote normal. There would be no more normal. So all this is happening all the time. And the reason I brought Guantanamo up is because it's an issue that it's like an unhealed sore. It is like an unhealed sore. It is a symbol of the it's a symbol of the hypocrisy of the United States. The United States, I mean, you know, God bless America, right? I mean, you know, I'm glad that I live in a place where still I have some, you know, control over what I can say, and I'm not, you know, threatened by the secret police, and I can get on this radio station, or other people can get on other radio stations and say, to criticize the federal government or what they're doing. People can demonstrate without, hopefully, I mean, although things are getting worse all the time, they can demonstrate without being attacked or locked up indefinitely, as they would be in a dictatorship. That there is more and more surveillance on all of us, even when we're not exercising our right to free speech, or even, you know, I mean, that they listen to that the government. And it's sad in a way when you say the government, because it's become, I think, for most people in this country, for one side or another, I mean, one way or another, I mean, this includes the right, the left, everybody, there's a sense that the government is a separate country. A separate superior country, almost like an occupying force. Like the federal government is like an occupying force in the United States of America, where once it was supposed to be, or maybe in many ways it was, a representative body of the citizens of the United States of America. Now it seems to be almost like a separate higher level, an elite colonial governing force, maybe an elite colonial governing force that represents the military, represents the wealthy, represents international corporations, and that we really don't seem to have that much control over it. It's an extraordinary thing. But when the government keeps a place like Guantanamo open and doesn't even bring people to trial and has people who could be released. I mean, just set aside for the moment that most of the people who were down there were in the wrong place at the wrong time, even according to military authorities that have reviewed these cases, that these people are actually innocent people that were picked up, that were turned in for rewards by people in their own countries, just, you know, and stories were made up, and they're not presented with evidence, they're not presented with their accuser, doesn't appear in front of them and say, you know, you did this and here's the proof. There's no right to trial, there's no right to anything. And that these people are down there, mostly innocent, and just being held there. I mean, many of them have actually, there are people who have died down there, there are people who have been tortured, there are people who have gone insane down there, and they're still there. I mean, they were picked up out of the blue by American forces or by CIA forces, American Army forces or CIA forces, and just locked up and transported over to this place. They have no idea, you know, a lot of them, where they were, and then finally they figured out where they are. They have no access to probably the most common protections that anybody, or even comforts, quote unquote, than anybody would have in a federal prison if they were locked up or in a state prison. It's just extraordinary. And the fact that this place is still open is a recruiting tool. It's a recruiting tool, just like the drone strikes often are. But this is a recruiting tool for more terrorism. And it's true that they have identified a couple of people who have been, or a handful of people who have been released from the Guantanamo prison, detainees, after all these years, went and joined up with rebel forces, with the Taliban and with other places that are fighting the United States or fighting against established governments in other countries. And why not? You know, I'm not suggesting that it's a good thing that they're doing this. I'm just saying, what else would you expect them to do? I mean, they lost track of their families. Their families drifted apart. They were a subject to this kind of abuse. I mean, how do you not react in some way with pure rage? And a way to get that out would be to join these rebel forces and to go straight back to a place. So even if they weren't, I don't know if they were or not, but even if these people weren't members of the Taliban, let's say, in Afghanistan, they are released and some of them found their way back to it. And certainly anybody who's been treated this way, forget about, they're not American citizens. And everybody has the right to be treated decently. Our democratic rights or our civil rights or our constitutional rights in this country only extended to people who are American citizens? I mean, there's a limit. We can't guarantee the freedom and security and the civil rights of people in the entire world. Although often when this country invades other countries or occupies other countries, they say they're doing it for that reason. But clearly they're not doing it for that reason. But is that where it stops? I mean, do we not want to treat everybody as a human being when refugees came to this country before, and we welcomed refugees, for a long, long time. We have this statue in the harbor in New York City, Statue of Liberty, which is a promise that when people come to this country, they won't be subject to pogroms and dictatorships and secret police and eternal poverty just because of the class or the race or the color that they are, that's why people came here from other countries where there was never, and this is not just ancient history, but there was never a chance that they would ever get anywhere. So they left these places where life was impossible, where they were being killed and locked up and terrorized and kept in a state just because of the class or race or religion they were, a state of poverty and misery and lack of the ability to advance themselves in their lives, like forever, for generations, for hundreds of years, for longer than that. And that's why that's why my ancestors came here. You know, that's why Jewish immigrants and Italian immigrants and Irish immigrants came to this country, German immigrants, other people came to this country in the first place. There's got to be. And are we not now, here's now Syrian refugees. The Syrian refugees have been victims and these are people who, have been gone through an incredibly long vetting process, sometimes like 2, 3, 4 years. These are families, people are families who have escaped, let's say, to Jordan. I mean, there have been hundreds of thousands, millions of people who have left Syria, innocent people, families, just regular people, because of the crazy fighting and the violence from every side that's gone on there, from ISIS and 20 different splinter groups and people supported by who knows who, and then, of course, the terrorism of the Assad government. And they've left these places. And they applied for for protection. They applied for the ability to emigrate to other countries, and the United States is one of these countries. And now we have people, a lot of these people are just making political points, like Trump and Carson and all the Republican candidates, and I think the Democratic candidates have said that they would have no problem accepting them. I think there was a poll done, who knows who did this, recently, that said most Americans said that they wouldn't have any trouble accepting Syrian refugees. These are people who have been vetted. They've never been, for all I know, accused of jaywalking in their own country or of even, you know, spitting into the street or something. These are just regular families. And all of a sudden, they're falling victim to this kind of crazy fear, which is drummed up by the media and which is reinforced by politicians. And then you've got something like, what, 25, 26 governors, I don't know how many, saying that, no, they would not accept Syrian refugees in their states. Are most of these governors Republicans? I suppose they are. I suppose they are. These are just regular people. And you think about what refugees, there's always a reason why refugees came to the United States, like I say, because they felt like it was a place, and it turned out to be an illusion for a lot of people, but it turned out to be the truth, that it was a place where people could really advance beyond their class, beyond religious intolerance, beyond the crazy rules and dictatorships of old European monarchies of other places. So a lot of our parents, grandparents, great-grandparents generation, whoever, however old you are, came from Italy and Poland and Russia and Lithuania and came from Ireland, where the British oppression of the Irish in the 1840s and 50s and 60s was unbelievable. I mean, if you've read books about it, it was astounding the way the British government and the British upper class and the British people in general, without knowing too much about it, basically were causing the Irish there to starve to death. They had no rights whatsoever, no civil liberties, and they had literally nothing to eat. They were just starving to death. So they came to the United States. The other side of why the United States always welcomed the refugees, and maybe this is part of the problem now, is that they could always use them for work. The United States was a gigantically expanding, of course, at the expense of the people who lived here originally, but that's a separate issue. You know, when the United States took over, when the Europeans took over the United States and pushed out or decimated the original inhabitants, the American Indians, they started building up, especially in the 19th century and the early 20th century, a huge, gigantic agricultural and industrial machine, one of the largest and maybe still the largest the world has ever seen, and expanded an economy. Companies that, didn't give anybody many rights. But what we needed, the bottom line here, I know I'm running on, the bottom line here is that we always needed refugees. We needed people. We needed workers. Like in Germany after World War II, there were so few men, able-bodied men, because so many German men had been killed in the war, that they accepted refugees from Turkey. there's a huge Turkish community in Germany, which has been there since after World War II, because the conditions were very bad in Turkey, and I don't know what the relationship was between the two countries, but tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Turkish men came there and eventually brought their families over to work in Germany. They needed workers. They needed people to perform labor. They needed people to open shops. They needed people to run simple, to run machinery, to take simple jobs, because they didn't have any men to work. So this country was expanding in the 19th century and the 20th century. I mean, expanding so rapidly industrially. They were building railroads, and there was mines, and all the work that was really back-breaking labor, and it was not covered by any unions, not covered by any federal protections, and all the garment trade. And so, the Statue of Liberty is true in its own way, but the country also needed, and I should say the country, big businesses, corporations, and in a way that was always the country itself, needed workers. They needed and then during the Civil War, the Union Army needed cannon fodder. It needed people to join the army. We were running out of people. A lot of people didn't want to fight in the Civil War in the North, And so we also welcomed Irish refugees. They got off the boat and they went straight. They went straight into the Union Army. I mean, they didn't even get off the docks. A lot of these guys, they were handed, they're handed a uniform and some sort of bonus as soon as they got off. And they said, "Here you are. You know, you can wander around with nothing to eat here, or we'll take you straight into the army. You'll get 3 squares a day." And then they put them straight into the army. The Chinese were welcomed here once upon a time in the late 19th century to build the railroads in the mid to late 19th century to build the railroads. The Irish also worked on the railroads. And Jews from Eastern Europe were welcomed here because they worked in the garment trades. And these people worked like dogs and had no protection whatsoever. So there's no avoiding economics. There's no avoiding capitalism when it comes to welcoming refugees. But still, I don't know if it's naive or delusional, you like to think that one reason why refugees were welcome to the United States was because, aside from our astounding hypocrisy and craziness when it comes to slavery and to the way we treated the original inhabitants here, because this was supposed to be a place, and very often was a place, where people had certain guarantees of liberty and certain guarantees of civil rights in the Constitution. And people all over the world, and still do to this day, from other countries where they are victims of dictatorships and victims of such extreme poverty, that they attempt to come into the United States legally and illegally. But now you're talking almost about a question of overpopulation. I mean, now the country is not expanding economically. We don't need all these workers to do all this hard work, except, of course, a lot of the Latino immigrants that are here legally and illegally are the ones who are doing all the hard work. All the bicycle delivery guys and people who are cleaning up kitchens and people who are doing work that a lot of Americans won't do, even, a lot of the agricultural stoop work that people do that Americans won't do or can't do or not able to do, can't live on. And so there's always this factor. It's mixed. I was brought up to believe that this is the home of the brave, the land of the free. It doesn't seem that way anymore. And it makes you afraid. It makes you afraid when you see things like Guantanamo still going strong and nobody getting their rights, when we're treating people, like ants all over the world and extinguishing people, when our government is spying on us, when we have fewer and fewer rights of freedom of speech and freedom of assembly here. Who knows but what everything that goes on this radio station is being recorded and processed by some government agency. And when I write essays, and I've recently written an essay on my website, by the way, the website to go to check out this essay I wrote about Paris and our sort of our reactions in the United States to it, emotional and political, is FaderFiles, FaderFiles.com, FaderFiles.com. And I welcome anybody who listens to the show or goes to visit that website to get in touch with me. There's a way to get in touch with me through the website. Well, that's all for today. It's just that I wanted to bring up Guantanamo again because I think people have forgotten it, and it is a recruiting tool for terrorism, like a lot of the other things we do in the world. I will see you next Monday.
Through the garden, you better watch your back. Well, I beg your pardon, walk a straight and narrow track. If you walk with Jesus, he'll save your soul. You gotta keep the devil. The fire and the fury at his command. Well, you don't have to worry if you hold on to Jesus' hand. We'll all be saved from Satan. forever.